Welcome to Search for Meaning with Rabbi Yoshi. I'm Yoshi Zweiback. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Why, when, where, what should I be? Is all I'm asking. Searching for the truth inside me that really matters.
Hey, it's the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, and we're joined this week by Harvey Kubernick and Hal Lifson, two experts on the era. Harvey's published dozens of books, hundreds of articles. Hal's a journalist with a deep background in music. We're going to talk about the meaning of Woodstock, the Jewish tie-in, why Dylan no-showed. You're going to love the conversation. Well, welcome, Harvey Kubernick, Hal Lifson. Pretty amazing year. It's 2019. And that means it is the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, August of 1969. Now, I was born in October 1969. And so I'm thinking about my 50th birthday, my 50th year, and the coming together of this momentous anniversary. And you guys know a lot about Woodstock. And I'm interested in hearing a little bit of your perspective and also looking at the Jewish angle, because this is Search for Meaning with Rabbi Yoshi. So got to figure out what is that Jewish angle. But let me start with you, Harvey. So, you know, you've written dozens of books on the history of rock and roll, thousands of articles. I know you appeared once on Hal Lifson's radio show. But you know as much about Woodstock as probably anybody. What are your first memories of Woodstock? You were a kid. You were a teenager.
In June of 1969, when I graduated Fairfax High School, I didn't even know what the prom was. I went to a rock and roll festival in Devonshire Downs in the San Fernando Valley called Newport 69 in June, like 19th, 20th, 21st of 1969.
It was called Newport
69? Newport 69 at Devonshire Downs.
Why Newport?
Because in 1968, in toward the beach, they'd had a Newport 68. It really wasn't affiliated with the Newport Jazz or Folk Festival. And I went to this festival, and I was searching for life because I had graduated high school, and the only place I could go to college with a student deferment was West LA Junior College. And I was really excited because that July I was going to go to summer school at West LA Junior College. So I'm in a world where I'm about to go to college, just finished high school. What am I going to do with my life? And So you were
searching for meaning. You were trying to figure
out. Yes, because
I
couldn't even get through the law school application. With a 2.2 GPA. What was my future? But I was going to figure it out.
And it was obviously an incredibly challenging time. We're in the middle of the Vietnam War, incredible unrest in America, racial divide.
And I'm coming out of, I've never said this, I'm coming out of a high school that's 97% Jewish, Fairfax High School. I never had saw a world, and I had come from a world of Culver City, and actually belonged to the YMCA in Culver City. So I'm seeing different parts of our world. So I went to Newport to the show out here, and they were talking about another big event in New York. Friends of mine were going to go to New York, and I said, oh, no, I've got to get a job. I've got college to start. I've got a life to live.
So you heard about Woodstock a couple of weeks before
because
Woodstock.
Because I was very plugged into the Paul Krasner started underground media, the Los Angeles Free Press. Rolling Stone had started in the end of 1968. I was reading this stuff at 16, 17, 18 years old, and I felt a connection that the albums that I was buying, the people that I was supporting for $2.98 an album, you mean it's no longer at the Shrine Auditorium or the Santa Monica Civic? Like, this rock and roll thing is like 30, 40, 50,000 people, like stadium? I said, I don't know if I want to be a performer, but I sure like this stuff, which is, actually, I made the decision after the Newport event I went to, not just to go to college, but to become like a library major and be a researcher, and it informs all the music, all the things I do now.
So you hear about Woodstock, and you can't make it, obviously, because you've got a million other things going on. So, Hal, you're 9 years old, 8 years old?
I was 9 years old that summer, but I was already very much entrenched in the music of the time, of the 60s decade, and this was kind of the finale to the 1960s, the summer of 69. And the Woodstock Festival represented so much more than just the music. It was a cultural event, and it was something that was larger than life. So you knew about it, you wanted to be a part of it, even if you couldn't attend.
So as a kid, before it even happens, you know this is happening, and you're hearing about the acts that are going to be there.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about Woodstock in the media. I listened to the radio incessantly throughout the late 60s, and certainly that year, some of the biggest groups that were actually appearing at Woodstock.
And the key thing why somebody like Hal in Encino, California, could know about this stuff, always remember, it might have not been in New York City, but it was in New York. And it's a world before satellite radio and cable television. But the networks, we're talking ABC, NBC, CBS, they all had crews. It was a New York birthed and developed event. So you had New York media and that mindset shoveling all the information with big PR firms involved too, and a consortium of record label companies.
So there was a lot of buzz.
And also the groundwork was set, I always felt, in 1967 with the Monterey International Pop Festival, a three-day event out up in Monterey, California. And a half a dozen of the groups at Monterey 2 years later played Woodstock. But the effects of Monterey were so strong that, like a record executive, Jerry Wexler, who I knew and I interviewed a few times, who was part of Atlantic Records, he acquired the soundtrack album for Woodstock weeks before the event, but he had been at Monterey International Pop Festival, and he had seen another soundtrack go to another label. So you had people, record label people, the Jerry Wexlers, Clive Davis attending Monterey, that were getting trenched in the new rock and roll. And by Woodstock, these groups had had 2, 3, 4, 5 albums out yet. So you had a lot of Jewish energy, just culturally and geographically, you know, as the floorboards of this.
And also in terms of the organizing of it. Now, in terms of the music, you know, you can have all of the hype that you could want around a concert, but at the end of the day, what actually happens? It's a live event. You know, what is actually going to happen there? So people can talk about Monterey until they're blue in the face, but what makes it legendary were the performances. And I'm guessing you would say that's the same thing about Woodstock. When you think about the performances, the iconic performances of Woodstock, what are some of those that stand out? Let me start with you, Harvey, and then I want to hear from Hal Lifson. Harvey, what are some of the performances of that three-day event that...
And most of us know Woodstock by the soundtrack album or the movie or the DVD or the 50th anniversary edition that's now out. But I always felt, even though he was not the first person to physically perform at the festival, Richie Havens really kicked things off. Actually, a local Los Angeles group called Sweetwater were technically the first group to play. They did the sound check in front of 250,000 people. They were supposed to open the event, but they got caught up in some kind of traffic stuff and couldn't, like, do their slot. So you have all this mythology around it, too. I think...
What made Richie Havens' performance so...
I think he paid for 2 hours and 45 minutes because he was getting the sound together, and he just got into a Richie trance, which I had saw in 1968 at the Shrine Auditorium when I saw him with the Vanilla Fudge. He could just go into ozone, cantorial almost, like it was musical cottage.
Now, he was not actually a trained cantor, though, right?
No. He had a Jewish manager, Mark Roth, I remember that.
Yeah, that's close
but,
enough.
But I thought Sly and the Family Stone really were strong, but part of that could be attributed to the editing of their performance in the movie by Martin Scorsese. But, you know, you get to see The Who and somebody like Joan Baez doing like Joe Hill. I mean, these things stick with us because the rock and roll movie was really starting to happen, and you can see this Woodstock constantly is celebrated. So when the movie propels it.
When did you get to see it? Because obviously there was media coverage.
I went
and
to
media
a premiere,
one
of the first screenings in Beverly Hills or Los Angeles. Somebody, I was in college, and I just said, I remember saying, is Santana in the movie?
But wait, but it's like a year, 2 years
it,
later,
it took
right?
a year and a half, about yeah. a year and a half. But they already had the movie deal in place. I mean, people knew we need to get this thing right. out. It didn't drag for years or months or months or months.
Right. Hal, what about you? What were some of the performances that you think? Obviously, you weren't there.
Right.
You didn't get to hear it all in real time, but you
know. I didn't get to see or hear it for nearly a year because it wasn't televised. So when the movie was out, there were clips from that. The album was something that teenagers in my neighborhood were listening to. So I got to hear Country Joe and the Fish do the famous chant that we won't repeat on your podcast.
No, but this is a family show, Hal.
There were things about it that felt important. It was also right at the same time the musical Hair had been very popular the year before. So there was a lot of rebellion, and the 60s ended on a much different note than when the Beatles came in at the beginning. And it was a different feeling. Rock music was really changing.
And the other thing about Woodstock, when it happened in August 69, we should always remember that the previous month, July 69, was the moonshot. And we meaning America or the world, was just kind of recovering from the assassination of Martin Luther King and, of course, Robert F. Kennedy. So a year later, we're on the moon. It's hot. It's a new world in front of us. And you kind of felt there was a new world ahead of us. The media,
so you mean like with a sense of hope?
Yeah, because America especially had gone through horrendous race riots in like 1967 and 1968. The anti-war movement was building. And the media was finally recovering from broadcasting news about hippies and people with long hair and beards in 66 and 67 and marijuana use and all that. Those stories had been out there 66 to 69. All of a sudden, there's an election going on. I mean, I worked for Eugene McCarthy. He was a poet from Wisconsin. I mean, a poet running for president. We like Kennedy too, but I was for the other guy. But the moonshot shows up. Something that John F. Kennedy wanted to do in this decade actually was accomplished in front of us. And then all of a sudden, you're in August. The Beatles are still together. The Beatles, our people, are still making music. The Rolling Stones are going to tour America in November of 1969. There's hope and possibility. And here comes Woodstock. Now, the media was blaring all the stuff about lifestyle and nudity and that kind of stuff. So most of the coverage was away from the music sometime. Because
so at the time, in the moment,
yeah.
that was a bit of the story.
It was more than a bit of
it. But not as much about the music.
Right, and what happens, the soundtrack then comes out on the heels of this, maybe in early 1970. You have a double album soundtrack with a volume two, and all of a sudden, Crosby, Stills, Nash and all these groups are on an album. And I interviewed Jerry Wexler, who made the deal for the record. He paid $6,000 for the rights to do this album.
Sadly, what we didn't know the weekend of Woodstock is that in just several weeks to follow this major music festival and gathering of young people, there would be shattering events in our world that changed the feeling of the hippie movement. And the two most significant ones were the Manson murders about a week or so after Woodstock and the killing at the Rolling Stones Altamont concert, which was in the wake of Woodstock.
So there was a violent
undercurrent and a very sad changing of the guard that took place in the late part of summer 69.
I never bought any of that. I believe, I haven't done the research, four people died at Woodstock of some accidents. Somebody got run over in a sleeping bag. So four people died at Woodstock. That's three more than Altamont.
Right, but it was considered a peaceful
event
for whatever reason.
Never compare Altamont to Woodstock.
And, I wasn't comparing, and, or just history.
The incidents you mentioned, the media did go in that direction with yellow journalism and coverage, and also it happened in Hollywood.
Right, but did those events, and obviously this is subject to interpretation, what, yes. Hal, what I'm hearing from you, Hal, is that there's this hopeful, exciting, life-affirming kind of energy that gets created, and then, but within a month of that, you have certainly the Manson murders, you know, and you guys were here in Los Angeles at the time. That's profoundly disturbing.
The entire culture of Los Angeles.
Actually, the media really globbed on to stuff like that. And I don't mean to be trivial about it, but all of a sudden, as a teenager back then, people like myself couldn't hitchhike anymore. And if we were growing our first beards and kind of had long hair, all of a sudden people were rolling up their windows.
Many celebrities moved out of their houses in the canyons.
Yeah.
In the months after.
As somebody once said, at the end of 1969, the party went indoors.
Wow.
Things did change. But also you have a president, you have a new president in office. But believe me, the napalm in Vietnam and ecology and all those things, to me, were much more important than these sad incidences that Hal, they're relevant, but there were much bigger concerns.
The premise of Quentin Tarantino's movie, without giving any spoilers away, the premise of his film is how the world had changed so much and in a cataclysmic way that he used the story of these actors or actor and a stuntman to show that in 1969, things were far different than just 5-6 years earlier. Well, the Woodstock Festival, by many historians and by many people that look very favorably upon that event, see Woodstock as the bookend at the end of the 60s. So right. They see Woodstock as the finale.
But Woodstock continued. There was a volume 2 of the soundtrack. All of a sudden, there were midnight movie screenings of Woodstock. There was eventually home videos of Woodstock. See, it did not end economically, fiscally, globally at the end of 1969 as far as retail awareness and product and promotion. Every group got bigger and bigger. The film wars kept going. All kinds of new rock venues.
What do you think, yeah. You know, when you think of all the big festivals
yeah.
that are, you know, from this era, Why is Woodstock the one that became so iconic?
Because it was a biological child of New York. It's, you know, in fact, even in the documentaries, you see Harry Reasoner or Frank Reynolds, these older newscasters from a half a century ago. They had affiliates in Madison Avenue. They had crews. They had reporters in the Tribune and eight wire services. So New York.
So geography really matters.
And it was Michael Lang, the main guy, one of the main guys of Woodstock, is born in Brooklyn. So you have New Yorkers involved also, and the Monterey Pop Festival out here was a nonprofit endeavor. The Woodstock one was for profit. Big difference.
But Woodstock still had the feeling, both on a marketing level and socially, as a cultural event, something even bigger than the music itself, and it's something that young people resonated toward for many years after Woodstock. And that became kind of the cornerstone to outdoor festivals like Coachella and things that we have today that in many ways take their roots and take their origin.
So therefore, Altamont did not end the free festivals. Woodstock was not the end of it. In fact, there are groups from Woodstock then that in August, like Carlos Santana, are playing in Bethel, New York 50 years later. So it was a launch pad. But it did, and by the way, it did show the world there was a lot more money in rock and roll as far as fashion branding, although the word wasn't quite. All of a sudden, advertising agencies are not treating rock and roll and pop music as a stepchild.
Let me ask a question about the meaning of it. You know, that's helpful in terms of the geography of it, why it became so iconic. But I want to go even maybe a little bit deeper in terms of why it touches people to this day. What was there something about it that you think had a deeper meaning? You know, there was a profit motive to be sure, but you know, when they say 3 days, what's the logo? 3 days of
love, peace,
and music. To what extent was that real?
Well, I'll tell you, and I've just done a lot of research on this and met just about all the principals. Just that's what I do. And it was originally kind of zoned maybe for 80,000 people. Maybe 400,000 showed up because it just spread by word of mouth. And it was something that the world needed. And also there was a sense of community on display. People were running out of food. Neighbors were getting sandwiches. The hog farm was there. There was really crazed weather conditions, and people kind of came together. And this was a mandate early on in the Woodstock promotions and the ethos of it. It was going to be an educational festival. There'd be drum circles. There'd be booths. I mean, this stuff kind of was happening out in L.A. at the Pleasure Fair out here in the 60s. So there'd be a sense of education, anti-war pamphlets, peace and love stuff, love beads, drum circles, candles for sale. So there was, but there were gurus doing kind of teaching stuff on meditation, and I'll say kind of early yoga practices around the facility. So you had that built in along with the music, which, by the way, has propelled itself that some of those kids, 10 and 12, who maybe went with an older brother, they're now 15, 60, like running yoga studios. I mean, some of their first awareness happened there because it was an outdoor event.
Woodstock was the graduation in a lot of ways for the Flower Children. It was their ceremony where they began to face their future as adults. So Woodstock was a major transition in their lives that the music was the soundtrack behind. But the significance of the event and the reason it resonated so deeply is that people that had experienced the 60s were now facing a new decade. The dawn of a new day was beginning, just months away. January of 70 was 4 months away. So I think people saw Woodstock as the gateway to the new world.
And also, simultaneously in the news broadcast, starting with Woodstock in early summer 69 and through the rest of the year and going into the early 70s, news was not a 24-hour cycle back then. It was a half-hour, hour a night, maybe three networks. And so the news was basically Vietnam body bags and fashion and, you know, the press conferences administrations would do. And all of a sudden, when you were seeing helicopters and people returning from Vietnam in body bags, it was kind of cool to see 10 seconds of a rock band on film coverage, or there's a hippie festival, or you saw there was like R&B performers with instrumental people, with the different communities all coming together. And it was a lot better to look at than, you know, General Westmoreland and people talking about the next plans for Vietnam, which really kind of doesn't end until 1973. And you have all this mobilization and anti-war stuff going on. So the news, after a while, people were getting tired of seeing the death count every night. So this was a little bit of a respite from it,
right,
too.
Let me ask a question about Bob Dylan. So, you know, when we think about Jewish artists, obviously he is the best known, most influential, perhaps artist of that era, but certainly Jewish artist, and does not perform in Woodstock. And one thing I read suggested that part of what they were hoping for, given the geography of the concert, is that they would have Dylan because he lived not too far away. But
Neil Diamond's manager would like to debate this with you.
No.
Yeah,
well, I'll give you the answer.
I want to hear why didn't Dylan play? And
I'll give you
what
the
does that
whole
mean? Yeah, let's hear it.
Mishpucha right here. Here's the spiel. Bob Dylan was approached by Michael Lang to play Woodstock. Michael Lang had a meeting with Bob Dylan and his then wife, Sarah, and offered $32,500 to play, the same amount of money Jimi Hendrix was getting. So he took a meeting on it. But also Woodstock for him was his sanctum sanctorum. He was a crazed, not he wasn't crazed, but it was a public figure with so much adulation and craziness and intruders on his lawn and houses and everything. He didn't need to go on public display at the time. He had really not performed too much in public. So he passed on Woodstock, although his manager at the time that he was severing connections with, Albert Grossman, managed the band who played Woodstock, managed Janis Joplin, who played Woodstock. So Bob Dylan formally passed playing Woodstock. But again, 3 weeks after Woodstock, he plays the Isle of Wight Festival in England for a $50,000 payday.
So are you suggesting...
And by the way, and then in 19...
Are you suggesting it was more geography or more money?
It might have probably a combination of the two.
He didn't want to play in his backyard.
He didn't want to play in his backyard. And then he did end up playing Woodstock at the 25th anniversary in 1994.
So he's got
depends on the deal.
So let me ask about the meaning side of it. As we look back, 50 years have passed. What's it mean? How does this experience set aside the geography and the media coverage and the for-profit motive and all of those kinds of things? What does it mean?
What it really means is that the children of the children who weren't even born yet at Woodstock, they're the people going to the EDM shows. They're the people that want to be in the arts. They're the people putting on the new festivals. They're the people becoming entrepreneurs. They're the people streaming music. So Woodstock created... See, what happened in 1972, Warner Brothers, Elektra Records, and Atlantic Records all formed and became the WEA Corporation. So all of a sudden, independent kind of record labels all came together. And of course, the Woodstock soundtrack was on one of those labels. So all of a sudden, rock and roll became very big business in the early 70s, really big business. And then all of a sudden, you have disco, which takes it up to another level. So what does it mean is that people that weren't born yet, but had an aunt or an uncle or a funny uncle or somebody who knew somebody who went to Woodstock, or my grandfather went to Woodstock, or my older brother went to Woodstock from a previous marriage or something, everybody is kind of chance-taking, doing art, playing music, doing drum circles, and the alternative consciousness that you had Maharishi, you had spiritual leaders on the premises of Woodstock, and people like Ram Dass have talked about the impact of the festivals. This stuff has been handed down, so what has gone on is that you now have more music people being more music lawyers because they see the economics of rock and roll and pop culture. And Woodstock brought a lot of that to the surface, that there was business here. And also you had people like
Matt. That's interesting because when you think about, sorry to interrupt, but when you think about what people say about Woodstock, it's never about the economics. It's always about, it's about the peace and the love and
Ram Dass,
the cultural experience.
Ram Dass instructed honor the incarnation. And that goes back to some of the tribulations Michael Lang, one of the main promoters, had to do to go get this thing. It was supposed to be held a little different place. And he found Max Yasger and said, here's $75,000. And Max Yasger, against his own community wishes, said, I want this to happen here. He was a dairy farmer. He needed the money, too. It was a hot summer before. He needed it, and he let that happen. They brought him on stage. He wanted freedom.
Many cultural anthropologists, historians have pointed out that it is the Woodstock event that represents the end of innocence for youth culture in our country, and that going forward after that, things were always compared to Woodstock. And here we are 50 years later, and the Woodstock festival that they were trying to have to honor the original has had nothing but problems. It's been canceled several times, rescheduled. So it's a real statement about where we've come 50 years later in putting on a cultural event like this and maintaining a certain innocence that really doesn't exist today.
Well, let me tell you, coming up on August 15th, we are going to do our part in a very small way. I want to be modest about it, but in a small way, we at Stephen Weiss Temple are going to do our part to try to recreate perhaps some of the magic. Beverly Hills, Cannon Gardens, we're going to be doing an evening of music inspired by, from Woodstock, and it's going to feature Cantor Lamb, Cantor Lutz, our Stephen Weiss Temple Band, so everybody should come out. And John Mirisch, who I recently interviewed for the podcast, mayor of Beverly Hills, is going to be there. Hal, Harvey, I'm hoping you guys will come and enjoy yourselves. Hopefully, you know, there won't be any arrests, nothing crazy will go down, but it'll be fun. There's not a profit motive. I want to be clear.
Is there parking? That's all I want to know.
You know what? It's the age-old question of any, and especially, I'm sure you feel this, Harvey and Hal, as you get a little older, you know, when you think about the concert that you're contemplating going to, parking becomes one of the most important questions.
Whoever thought logistics like that would be concerned, but I did see something in the newspaper, and I said to myself, I don't know if it's me or if I'm getting old, because I wasn't going to this concert, but I saw an ad for a show, I think at the Wiltern Theater, and in the ad it said, seated venue.
There you go.
I said to myself, well, I like to stand at a show, but I realized you have the Alta Cocker action going on too, which might be over 40 these days, not 65. You have to give the specifics of the dynamic and the logistics
of where you're going.
You've got to know these things now.
Well, we should point out,
is there parking in Beverly Hills, and is it a two-hour limit?
On August 16th, we'll have a Shabbat Woodstock tribute here at Wise Temple with very comfortable padded seating.
Yeah,
available.
No,
and for all audience members,
it's going to be great. We're going to be actually outside. We're going to enjoy the lawn. We'll have chairs, but you can also come and sit on the lawn. Let me ask a final question to each of you, and it's not about Woodstock in particular. It's more generally about music. Music means so much to both of you. I know from my conversations that I've had with you, from enjoying music with you, from reading some of the things that you've written about that popular culture. So many of these bands are, you know, part of your own concept, you know, your own history,
DNA.
They're part of who you are, not just the soundtrack of your life, but so much of, it's like they're your friends. Some of them actually are your friends because you've interviewed them and you know them. But when you think about music more broadly, you both grew up Jewishly and are connected to, you know, your Jewish identity. Where's that intersection of music, spirituality, your Judaism, rock and roll? How does it come together for you? And how does it express itself? How does it give you a sense of meaning in your life?
You know, most of the time when I've been betrayed or stabbed or haven't gotten the gig or you name the hundreds of little incidents, music has been my best friend. And not that I'm moping or crying over somebody wouldn't go out on a date with me or I lost a job on the Warner's lot or something, but when you don't get the gig or you're not hired or things aren't working and you see chaos around you or tragedies to friends or in your own family, you reach for that album. And if you play vinyl, it's a very romantic experience because you're stationary and you're stuck flipping the record over. It's not some mobile groove scene streaming and driving in your car if you're playing, you know, albums. And it was music is a lifesaver for me. I never ascribe Judaism aspects to it, although I end up, somebody said to me, what are you going to do after Leonard Cohen? What's the next Jewish songwriter you're going to write a book on? And I said, The next one's a guy named Neil Young. I mean, I didn't corner the market on that. But music, it was beyond a life raft. It was my best friend. It still is, and it's beyond comfort, and it fortifies me. And what happens because of CDs and streaming and box sets and greatest hits and re-releases and things like that, the more you do not burn out on it, you, after 5, 10, 15, 20 years, sometimes like a good movie, you'll rediscover or discover things you didn't hear before, whether it be the lyrics or on headphones, or you're familiar with, hey, that's an instrument I'd never heard. So it's in a constant state of feeding somebody like me.
In 1969, I began my journey in Judaism. I started Hebrew school that year. And it was through music that I developed my first affiliation to spirituality. And throughout my life now, fortunately, I've been able to share my love of music with many people, now my children. And even more fortunately, the music of 1969 and the decade of the 60s has really survived. Many of the artists from Woodstock are still performing. Carlos Santana, two members of the original Who, are outperforming 50 years later their music that began in this major decade of music, the 1960s.
Let me mention one thing it should be said. When I was going to Hebrew school in the mid-60s on Robertson Boulevard, I never could grasp up the street on the same street there would be people from India in robes and things like that. I didn't know who they really were. And I have had and have great parents that were not too judgmental on long hair and beards and all that. And I never knew about this place they were going to called the Kanara School of Music. It's the same block that now houses the Kabbalah Center. I didn't know I was on a street like Pico and Robertson that was delis and bagel shops and various forms of places to investigate. And I didn't realize it until after Woodstock when I saw the movie. And I was hearing about this guy Ravi Shankar. And he helped fund a music school called the Kanara School of Music. George Harrison would go there. And part of the Kanara School of Music was funded when Ravi Shankar used some of the monies from the Monterey International Pop Festival. He was one of the few performers to get paid because he had a contract that was honored before it went nonprofit. So he took that money and put it into the Kanara School of Music. So I'm seeing Indian, I'm hearing Indian music a little bit, and besides hearing it in Peter Sellers movies and all that, and I'm making the connection of spirituality and Indian music and Judaism and all that, and the sitar, and kind of all these things were feeding into each other. But sometimes you don't realize these things till later. And so Ravi Shankar appeared at Woodstock. Ravi, he's not on the soundtrack or in the movie. He's in the Monterey. So you realize that
he performed there. They just didn't.
Right. There are many performers that performed there that either
Creedence Clearwater.
Yeah. So a lot of them.
Not in the movie.
Some of them didn't want to be in the movie. Some of them, there were machinations on economics. Some of them, the film didn't. They were out of. Like Johnny Winter wanted to be in the movie, but he was out of tune. So there was a lot of things.
Well, there is that. You know, you got to be careful when that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, the investment we've all had on Woodstock, it still continues.
Ronald Reagan wanted to be in the Woodstock film, but it was considered that he was out of touch, so they wouldn't let him be part of it because of his politics.
It was about the GE Theater with him. Okay,
so. A lot of people have pointed out that Woodstock was the beginning of a new chapter. So in our next interview, we'll discuss the 1970s and how that chapter worked out for America.
Mm-hmm. We'll continue the conversation. Hal Lifson, Harvey Kubernick, I want to thank you for your time, and I want to invite everybody to join us coming up August 15th at Cannon Gardens in Beverly Hills for a stroll down memory lane as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. Thanks for helping us understand the meaning, a little bit of the backstory, and how it's touched you personally, and a little bit about the way it gives meaning to your life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Well, there you have it. Harvey Kubernick, Hal Lifson, reflecting on the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, what that weekend meant to them, what it means to us today. I want to remind you to come out to Cannon Gardens in Beverly Hills on August 15th to see the Stephen Wise Temple Band celebrate Woodstock. We'll be doing Woodstock covers. And then the following evening, Friday, August 16th, we're going to celebrate Shabbat, but we'll bring in some of the spirit and music and beauty of Woodstock that evening. Hope to see you all then. Thanks so much for tuning in.